Pro teams have millions to spend, and they don't always spend them wisely. But when it comes to a great shave, you don't have to shell out tons of cash. Harry's saw customers getting ripped off by the shaving industry, with overpriced, underperforming products, and decided to do something better. They found their own way to make beautifully designed razors for a fraction of the price of the other big brands, so you never wonder if you overpaid. Harry's shaving products look great, and the weighted handle makes shaving feel great, too. I like to keep my beard neat, and Harry's always leaves me with a smooth yet crisp shave. Harry's quality is top-notch, thanks to German-engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. You can get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. And Harry's has the highest customer satisfaction in the shaving industry, plus a convenient subscription option that you can cancel at any time. Getting the best doesn't mean spending the most when you shave with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. That's harrys.com/bluewire for a $3 trial set.
I don't know. Summertime's kicking in a little bit. It's warm outside. I'm ready. I could use a little break.
Okay. We do have unlimited PTO. Take a little break.
Yeah, I do. The unlimited PTO is the absolute worst thing that's ever happened to me in my professional life. Seriously, man. So we have unlimited PTO. Now, granted, like, I got a doctor's appointment at 1:30. Got to run off to whatever. Right. Like, that makes life a lot easier, right? But when it comes to, like, actually taking, like, vacation time, I took 2 weeks last summer. That's the last vacation I took, right. You know? And I'm going to take another 2 weeks this summer, and I'm pretty sure that's the last 2 weeks I'm going to take for the whole year. Now, when I started working here, we got 3 weeks vacation time. So I'm taking less time because we have unlimited PTO. Is this just pure Jewish anxiety, or is this?
I think so. Some combination of Jewish anxiety and, you know, you need structure and discipline in your life. You need someone telling you the rules, seems to be. Leaving you to your own devices sort of backfires. You overcompensate.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point.
How much should I charge you for this therapy session?
Whatever you think, I think, because man, I think you're, you know,
wait. There I go. I left it up to you for how much to charge you. We're never going to get an answer.
Gamble on, fellas. Gamble on.
Welcome again to Gamble On, the weekly gambling podcast presented by USBets.com. I'm Eric Raskin, USBets Managing Editor and Media Director, and I'm joined by my co-host, USBets Senior Analyst Jeff Edelstein. This week on the show, we'll cover the latest details of the various college sports betting controversies, examine an adversarial marketing play from Profit Exchange, and dissect the biggest pot in the history of live-streamed poker. Plus, I'll whine just a bit about the Derek White tip-in that cost us much-needed fake money.
And we're also going to be welcoming our U.S. Bets and Sports Handle colleague Mike Seely to the podcast. We're talking East Coast versus West Coast, NBA Finals betting, and a fair warning about a 10-minute conversation on Succession, which occurs about 9 minutes into the interview. So if you don't want to hear it or if you haven't seen it yet, you know, skip through there. But, you know, really, by this point, come on, stop it already. All right, before we get to all that, though, as always, Eric, plenty of news to discuss.
Here's your Gamble On News of the Week, an inside look at the biggest stories in the world of gambling.
We start the news section this week with more college baseball betting concerns and controversies as some details of a scandal we recently discussed are getting filled in. Last week, the University of Cincinnati announced it had fired two assistant baseball coaches, with Fox 19 Cincinnati reporting that the coaches knew about a player's parent wagering on games, and the coaches failed to report the violation to either the school's athletic department or the NCAA. It was a few days later that the connection between this story and the highly publicized Alabama betting scandal became clear. Sports Illustrated reported that Bert Neff Jr., the father of Cincinnati pitcher Andrew Neff, placed the red flag raising Alabama LSU bets at a sportsbook in Cincinnati, allegedly while in communication with since fired Alabama coach Brad Bohannon. On Wednesday, the Cincinnati head coach, Scott Guggins, resigned, although it was unclear if it had anything to do with betting since he was not accused of any NCAA rules violations. We should also note that, according to reports, Andrew Neff, the Cincinnati student athlete, is not implicated in any of this. The obvious question here, Jeff, is whether knowing that a player's parent was betting on college baseball and not reporting it to anyone should be a fireable offense. What are your thoughts on that and any other comments as this story continues to unspool?
Yeah, I think to begin with, I think anyone named Bert Neff should immediately be investigated by authorities. It's a crazy name, Bert Neff. Sounds like an Elmore Leonard villain.
I guess.
I don't know. Listen, I really don't know. I mean, I guess the coaches know that there was some kind of, intelligence being passed along here. I mean, the details are too fuzzy. I mean, is it a fireable offense? I guess if they knew that the guy was getting some inside info, then probably. But, like, honestly, at the end of the day here, to use every cliche in the book, the NCAA's general sense of sticking their head in the sand on gambling issues is just going to continue to be a pain in the ass, really. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That to me is going to remain the biggest story in all of this, is that, like, if the NCAA was a lot better when it came to all this, then I don't think we'd be having these issues.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be something more to it with the two assistant coaches who got fired. Just knowing that a player's dad was betting on games and not telling anyone, if that's really all it was.
Who cares?
That should be at most a stern warning, sort of a you're in trouble if you don't report this sort of thing next time, maybe at most. So,
if my kid's playing NCAA sports, I can't bet. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, that's why there's got to be more to it than,
right?
Because you should be able to, and even the coaches can know that you're betting. There has to be a more direct connection here. So I'm assuming there is. I will just issue a pure speculation warning here. None of this is fact. This is just what it could be. But it seems like either these two assistant coaches were engaged in the betting themselves and coordinating with Neff. Hey, put $500 down for me while you're there, something like that, or they were feeding Neff inside information about their team and their players, or at the very least, they knew all the details of the Alabama betting scandal and the inside info that he was getting, and they didn't tell anyone, even when the NCAA was going around asking the college baseball community, essentially, if you have information about this, come forward. It has to at minimum be that they knew a lot and didn't come forward on the specific scandal, not just on the fact that this guy was betting. I don't know. I can't imagine they got fired just for knowing that a player's dad liked to bet on college baseball games and failed to report it. Like you said, that
I would hope
seems
not.
It shouldn't be a violation.
Yeah, I know. I would hope not. I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll eventually know the whole story whenever the NCAA decides to tell us the whole story. But I got yelled at a few weeks ago by gambling Twitter with my stupid, but it was just a thought experiment.
It's not a bad thing if gambling Twitter is yelling at you, for the record. It may mean you're doing something right.
No, I mean, my point was that it was a modest proposal, like Jonathan Swift eating a baby. Like, obviously, I didn't really mean for it, and I said so in the column that I really didn't mean for it.
Right. Nobody but reads that, the column, Jeff.
Nobody
you know
reads
that.
They just read the headlines.
Yeah.
But, like, the idea being that, like, the sports books should be like, yo, NCAA, get your head out of your ass. Let's get, can we please, like, start having injury reporting?
Right.
Can we please, allow athletes to place a legal wager on games that they're not participating in. This is craziness, because all it's going to do is continue to give the industry a black eye, not the NCAA.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. More everything out in the open, more reasonable rules, more clear reporting on everything, and you avoid situations like this. And it's still just kind of funny to me to zoom out and note that this all started because a guy bet on a heavily favored team to win and they won. I realize there's a lot more to it than that, but just on the surface, the game and the result just aren't anything unusual, but it spiraled from there. Just one last note is you singled out Bert Neff Jr. as the name that has your attention here.
Yes.
The name that has my attention is Scott Guggins. Tough name, Guggins.
Tough name.
Not that different from Walton Goggins, but somehow Goggins is way better than Guggins, even though it's just one letter off, so.
Yeah, I've always wanted to write an Elmore Leonard style novel. I think this might be
you're going to build it around Burton F. Jr.
This might be the precipitating incident.
Okay, can you put a Googans in your novel as well?
Done.
Okay.
Pro teams have millions to spend, and they don't always spend them wisely. But when it comes to a great shave, you don't have to shell out tons of cash. Harry's saw customers getting ripped off by the shaving industry with overpriced, underperforming products and decided to do something better. They found their own way to make beautifully designed razors for a fraction of the price of the other big brands, so you never wonder if you overpaid. Harry's shaving products look great, and the weighted handle makes shaving feel great too. I like to keep my beard neat, and Harry's always leaves me with a smooth yet crisp shave. Harry's quality is top-notch, thanks to German-engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. You can get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. And Harry's has the highest customer satisfaction in the shaving industry, plus a convenient subscription option that you can cancel at any time. Getting the best doesn't mean spending the most when you shave with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. That's harrys.com/bluewire for a $3 trial set.
Let's move on to our second story, which takes us to Jeff's home state, New Jersey, the best state to live in if you're a sports bettor looking to have as many options as possible for how and where to make wagers. New Jersey is the only state with sports books that offer exchange wagering right now. And one such operator, Profit Exchange, has gotten aggressive and creative in courting customers, specifically by encouraging them to bet with the competition. When one of the major sports books like FanDuel or DraftKings offers a boost on a specific bet, Profit is encouraging customers to make that boosted bet and place an arbitrage bet at Profit Exchange at a price that guarantees the bettor will come out ahead. For example, FanDuel had a boost on Heat Celtics Game 7 for either Tatum or Adebayo to score the first basket at +300. Profit priced a bet on anyone other than Tatum or Adebayo to score the first basket at -250. So you bet both sides at an amount that Profit Exchange spelled out on its social media account, and you lock in a small win no matter what. Seems to me a smart way to get the attention of bettors and maybe attract a few new customers. Jeff, what do you think of this marketing move, and any new thoughts on the long-term viability of an exchange wagering site?
I love marketing moves when companies like, you know, directly take on other companies like Pepsi Challenge. Like, that was awesome. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, we're just going for it, you know? So yeah, I think it's smart. You know, I think it's fun. And I don't know. I think that these exchange sites like Profit and Sport Trade here in New Jersey, they'd have a lot more potential if they were allowed to cross state lines, right? Like, even if they get legal in all 50 states, you're not going to be able to, you know, like, have a liquid market in all 50 states, you know, like, with money transferring back and forth. So that's not going to happen. But the key to their success, I think, it's been about a year now that they've both been live. Mm-hmm. But I think the key to their success is crystal clear, and it's to steal another marketing line. Remember Sims, the suit people?
They sell suits.
Sims. SYMS. You're gonna remember when I give you their marketing.
All right, let me hear it.
An educated consumer is our best customer.
I really don't remember. I know the Pepsi Challenge, but I don't know the Sims stuff.
Well, maybe Sims was just a New York thing. But their tagline was, an educated consumer is our best customer. I'm getting to a point, trust me. So I mean, Sims is out of business also, so maybe it's worth nothing. But the point is that Profit and Sport Trade, honestly, they should be cleaning up in New Jersey. I mean, they routinely have better odds, you know, on money lines and spreads and totals, you know, in New Jersey. But people just don't know or don't care. You know, if I was running marketing for them, I don't know how you do it, but I just actually like hand out $100, you know, here's $100, you know, here's $200. Come to my site and bet.
Right.
No strings attached. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because listen, if you're, you know, now granted, I know like most recreational bettors, present company included, are not that price sensitive. We're betting SGPs. We're doing this, you know, betting parlays, yada, yada, yada. But like, really, if you're betting straight, you know, money lines or spreads or totals like in New Jersey, and you're not betting with these guys, you're leaving money on the table every time, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that you really nailed it there with sort of the people either don't know or don't care I think a lot of it is the don't care. That I think that the this marketing move kind of speaks to what exchange wagering is as compared to betting against the house with the giant sports books. That, you know, exchange wagering is for the serious bettors who are looking to grind out profits and actually make money as opposed to losing money slowly for entertainment purposes. You know, the pros and the semi-pros seem to love exchange wagering, and Arbing fits right in with that. You know, you are looking to make a boring, no sweat, $5 wherever you can. So I like the marketing move. It's potentially attention getting, but it very much fits the mold of Profit Exchange or Sport Trade or any other exchange wagering site. I'm not sure if it has any wider appeal. You know, if the is the casual bettor interested? Do they care about that ARB to lock in a few dollars of profit? There's no entertainment in that. So they may say, nah, I have my FanDuel account. I'm putting $50 on a game, or I'm doing a $10 SGP. I'm good. So I like this marketing idea. It's creative. It's interesting. It's something we can write about. But I think it's possible that Profit Exchange is just marketing to its existing audience here pretty much. And that the better move might be what you said, give everyone $200 to convince them to give exchange wagering a try, because they probably just either don't know about it or aren't interested in trying it until they get a taste for it.
I'm really toying with the idea of writing a story or a column or a feature or something, like asking like the question, like, why are we so stupid?
I think it's a fun column idea. Why does the average sports bettor not like making money, basically?
Yeah, because like I think like you care, like when you go to the supermarket, you care. Like when you're trading stocks, you care. See Robinhood, right? Like, I don't know. It just seems like, you know, why would you leave money sitting on the table? It just doesn't make sense. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Nothing pleases me more than catching a little ARB or taking a casino bonus and turning it into $5 right. And say, oh, well, that's like $5 less than I'm going to lose today. You know what I mean? Like playing DFS or whatever. I don't know. It seems foolish to me. It just seems like there's very few people that are price sensitive in this world when the whole point is money. Like, this is exactly where you want to be price sensitive.
Yeah, the whole point is money to some, and it's entertainment to others, I guess. But even those who are just doing it for entertainment are hoping to win
money.
It's not like
if I go to the supermarket, I could spend $5 for the Heinz ketchup or $3 for the ShopRite ketchup. Well, at least I'm getting a ketchup here, and like it might mean something to me for the $2.
Right.
But if I'm betting $5 at DraftKings and $5 of profit, like to win, I'd rather win 5.25. Then win, you know, $4.95. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. It's just money. There's no ketchup.
It's just money. There's no ketchup. That should be a slogan for somebody, I would think. I can already see. I love the idea of this opinion article, and I can already see us writing a headline that oversimplifies it and gets you in trouble. All sports bettors are stupid by Jeff Edelstein, and nobody clicks on the story to understand why, and you just take a lot of heat for it.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Okay. For our third story this week, we're going to talk poker, but it's not World Series of Poker related, even though the WSOP did start Tuesday. The poker spotlight was stolen late Tuesday night when Hustler Casino Live played host to the biggest pot in the history of live-streamed poker. Tom Dwan, one of the best high-stakes cash players in the world for the last 15 years plus, won a $3,081,000 pot against Chinese pro Westside Wesley Fay. And it was made all the more entertaining because the broadcast failed to read Dwan's cards. So the audience was following along blind, knowing what Wesley had, but not what Dwan had. Wesley had ace-king, which Doug Polk in the seat next to him saw by accident. And Wesley 3-bet with the ace-king preflop. Dwan 4-bet, Wesley 5-bet, and Dwan called. On the 8-8-3 flop, Dwan checked, Wesley bet, Dwan called. The turn was a 5, exact same action, check, bet, call. And on the river, a 6, not a card likely to change much. Dwan checked. Wesley moved all in for Dwan's remaining $786,000 into a pot that already had $1.5 million in it. Wesley buried his head. Dwan talked it over and thought it over for several minutes and finally made the call with pocket queens, which of course beat Wesley's ace high. So Wesley lost about $1.5 million in a single hand on what ultimately was a bluff. I have a long viewing history with Dwan. I find him about as entertaining to watch as any poker player. Not sure if you were familiar with him before this or not, Jeff, but give me your thoughts on how it played out and whether it gave you the itch to gather up a couple million bucks and sit down in a big cash game.
Yeah. No, it was very exciting to watch it. I went, you know, when the post moneymaker, you know, I went just like everybody else. I watched a lot of poker, but I haven't watched it in years. I never, you know, didn't know who any of these people were.
Okay.
But I was, it was curious to me that the hand played out the way it did. It made sense, obviously, for Dwan to stay in and on, you know, pre-flop or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end, it seems like this is why I'm not a professional poker player, for the record, because I would have ran far away at that point. I would have, like, you know, cut my losses. No, I don't know.
So you're saying if you were holding the pocket queens, even if you'd called the flop and the turn when he goes all in on the river, even if we let's shrink the amounts down to a more reasonable. Let's say that it was, you know, you sat down with $500 and the last of your $500 was now being put at stake. At that point, you're believing him that your queens are no good and you're flopping.
I don't know. I used to play poker with my friends like on a daily basis, like, you know, late high school, college. Like I thought, and I was pretty good. I thought I was like the king of poker, right. You know, and then I went to Atlantic City and I played like an $80, $60, whatever hold'em tournament.
Mm-hmm.
I remember sitting at the table shaking, like a leaf, and playing horrible poker and feeling. You know, like that old line, I forget, maybe it's Doyle Brunson who said it, but I don't know who said it. But, you know, if you look around and you can't spot the sucker, it's you.
Uh-huh.
I looked around. I spotted the sucker immediately. And it was me. Like, and everyone else did. If I had lasted 5 minutes, I mean, I am not cut out for this world of poker playing. So I don't know what I would have done. But like, just to see that hand through and I know like these poker players say that the money is not real money to them, you know, it's blah blah blah, but still, I don't know how, that's too much for me, too rich for my blood.
Yes, to use yet another cliche. So I know the line first from Rounders about spotting the sucker, but it may have existed somewhere else before that. Maybe Doyle did originate it, I have no idea. But the shaking thing, very relatable. I definitely, when I play live poker, which is very rare these days, and even when I was playing somewhat live poker, I was still not something I did with great frequency anyway. I've had some live poker success. I've won some small tournaments, but I'm always nervous as hell the first few times I play hands until, like, you've won a big pot. Once you've, like, scored one big pot, you've beefed up your stack a little bit, then I relax, and like I've gotten to like the final table toward the end, by then like the nerves are gone. But early on, absolutely, like, just freaking out about the very idea of having to play a pot against somebody. It's so weird how that kicks in that way. In this particular hand, I found the factor of Doug Polk seeing the cards to be a fascinating wrinkle. I suspect that Dwan was able to deduce from the way he was talking that Wesley probably didn't have pocket aces or pocket kings, and maybe that made all the difference in him making the call. You know, Dwan seemed more worried about trip eights with 8-9 suited or some kind of hand like that. But, you know, if that made the difference, that, of course, is all Wesley's fault. He wasn't protecting his cards, and then he openly showed Polk after Polk had folded his hand. So that may have backfired on him. If I'm going to critique Wesley's play, I think the third barrel on the river against Dwan was a mistake. I think fire on the flop, fire on the turn, but once he's checked, called you twice, he has to have a hand. Even when we as the audience didn't know his cards, I actually was thinking pocket queens exactly, just based on the way the hand had played out to that point. Maybe jacks or tens. It didn't seem like kings to me until Dwan, you know, when he started thinking out loud on the river, he said, like, he was like wondering if Wesley had aces. That's the first time that I thought maybe Dwan has kings. But I kind of thought if he had kings, he probably would have put in another bet pre-flop, a six bet. So I doubt he's calling flop and turn with like ace queen or something like that. And there's a very good chance he's making the call on the river with any overpair. Seems to me like Wesley's river bet only really works if Dwan happens to also have ace king, and then you're successfully bluffing him off a split pot. But you know, for the most part, that was one of those situations where Wesley is going to get called by the hands that beat him, and the hands that he can beat are going to fold to him. So he should probably just check his hand at that point and hope that ace king is good. But it's a gutsy river bet. It takes a lot of balls, but I think it was a mistake, at least against Tom Dwan. I guess not against you.
No, I would have folded like a cheap suit from Sims.
Nice.
It's time to welcome a special guest from the world of gambling. Let's get to the Gamble On interview.
One of the highlights for me of the SBC North America Summit a couple of weeks ago was finally meeting in person a gentleman I've been working with for a couple of years now, but I only knew him over Zoom, Google Meet, and Slack until our overdue man hug in New Jersey. He is a return guest on Gamble On, but this is his first appearance in the Edelstein era. He is an editor and writer for US Bets, Sports Handle, and MI Bets, an experienced drinker of booze and smoothies in equal measure, a diehard Seattle sports fan, and someone who's a little too into Taylor Swift for a guy in his 40s. US Bet senior analyst Mike Seeley, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, good to be here, fellas.
So as I mentioned, you were at the SBC Summit in Jersey, and then you hit the road again soon after for a conference in Vegas put on by UNLV's International Gaming Institute. Give me a little compare contrast between the two events. Like, I tend to have the attitude that if you've seen one industry conference, you've seen them all. But did either of these provide a counterpoint to that?
Yeah, well, the first counterpoint is the difference between Secaucus, New Jersey, and Manhattan that we experienced at the SBC Summit. Thankfully, Secaucus is but one easy New Jersey transit bus ride away from Manhattan. And I did get to eat at Red Robin for the first time in a long time, so that was good. But to your main point, SBC and UNLV's International Gaming Institute Conference could not be more different. And it's very heartening in that way. You know, you go to SBC and it's what you would expect out of a gambling conference. You know, it's mostly male. There's a lot of deal making, panel discussions that, you know, reveal some enlightening stuff, but can tend to divert towards standard issue talking points at times. The UNLV summit couldn't be more different. I mean, it's first of all, it only occurs once every 3 years. They had the presence of mind to somehow schedule around COVID. And most of the crowd comes in from out of the country. So Americans are in the minority at that conference, I would say. And also in terms of gender split, it's pretty close to 50-50 men and women. So I think what I found there is, you know, we're a very immature gambling market here in the United States, both in terms of sports betting and really gambling at large. But if you look at the rest of the world, it's just kind of woven into the cultural fabric, especially in Australia. And, you know, you've got these brilliant minds who study this industry like it's any other, which it is. So that was, really, really reassuring and heartening for me. It really made my brain hurt trying to get my head around all this stuff that was discussed. But hey, it's good to test our boundaries at times. And that IGI conference was really great for that.
You know, you mentioned the, you know, how it's not, how sports betting isn't really, you know, taking hold where you are. I'll get my words together. Don't worry. And, you know, I'm on the East Coast. I'm in New Jersey. Eric's, you know, here in Pennsylvania. You know, sports betting is now part of the fabric of the conversation for sports fans around here. And I'm guessing it's not really out in Washington. You know, the West is the pioneer spirit. Where you guys are dropping the ball here. Now that you spend some time on the East Coast here during legalized sports betting, what outside of the obvious difference, like that there's sports betting here and there isn't where, you know, in Washington, outside of tribal casinos, I believe, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So what do you think's holding it up? What's the differences? What is the, you know, go West, young man, go forth and prosper. What's going on?
Well, you touched on one of them. I mean, the biggest difference, if you're just talking about the Pacific Coast, Washington, Oregon, California, tribes have a tremendous amount of political clout to the point where you're not going to find many lawmakers in either party willing to take them on. If it doesn't have the tribe's approval, you're not getting it done, especially in Washington. And I think, you know, obviously we saw what happens when the commercial entities take on the tribes in California. That doesn't float either. So yeah, here in Washington, we just have sports betting at tribal casinos. You have to physically go to one, which, to be honest, for someone like me, probably a good guardrail. But in Oregon, DraftKings has the mobile monopoly through the lottery. California's got nothing. And then you got Alaska and Hawaii, which I'll throw in here. I think they just want to be different and are still kind of pissed off about us colonizing them.
How, you know, I have a question for you now. I mean, maybe it's East Coast bias, but when I think of Washington, Oregon, and California as like one block, basically, because it's all connected and it's on the coast. You guys consider Alaska, why they're like little brothers of yours, or how does that work?
Oh, I think Washingtonians have a real kinship with Alaska. I mean, if for no better reason than Alaska Airlines is headquartered in Seattle. Okay. That's the connection for me.
I'm learning something new every day. I don't care about anything in between the coasts. So this is illuminating. I appreciate
it. It's all just flyover country to you,
that's,
huh, Jeff?
That sure is.
All right, let's talk some NBA, since you are probably the chief hoopsologist on our staff, Mike. The finals start Thursday night. I expect Denver to win this series convincingly. I expect Jokic to win MVP of the series. But for game one, with the rust factor for the Nuggets, what do you think of Miami on the money line? I'm seeing them as high as +310 at Caesars and FanDuel. Is there a decent chance that they become the first road team to win a playoff game in Denver this postseason?
Oh, very much so. I mean, you know, first of all, they're a great road team, and they've been a great road team in these playoffs. Second of all, what you mentioned, you know, Denver's had, what, 8 days off, or will have had 8 days off by the time Thursday night's game tips off. Absolutely, rust could be a factor there. And unfortunately, the NBA cuts the team that goes seven games a little too much slack. I mean, they should be playing a little bit earlier to give Denver the right advantage and to, you know, make sure Miami, or if Boston had emerged from that series, to make sure they're properly fatigued. What I'm saying is, going up, you know, sweeping should be a bigger advantage in terms of scheduling. But no, not only do I think Miami has a good chance of winning game one, I think they have a good chance of winning game seven in Denver. And I think they have a pretty good chance of winning the series.
Wow. Okay. Cause I'm coming in feeling like, as great as Miami's run has been this postseason, that it's been against the right sort of flawed teams, and Denver is not showing any of those flaws so far and has been so hard to beat at home. Even if Miami can steal one game, sounded that they may need to steal two to win this thing. To me, my first thought was Denver in five, something like that. But you think Miami's pretty live to win the whole thing?
I do, and odds makers tend to agree with you here. But I'm basing my logic on the fact that, you know, this Denver team has never been to a finals before, and sometimes you kind of have to knock on the door before you get it done. Now, that being said, I want the Nuggets to win. Eric, you know from our arguments over Slack that I'm the biggest Nikola Jokic stan around, and you're the biggest Joel Embiid stan around.
I was until a couple of weeks ago.
Now, right. Well, there you go. Now, so now I do want Denver to win from a fan's perspective, just to show, just to shut that whole argument down about who the best player and center is in the NBA.
I think most people would say for the moment that argument has been shut down. Even Philly fans are not trying to claim Embiid is better than Jokic.
We'll see. Nick Nurse
seems even Bucks fans are kind of like, at this point, it's Jokic has passed Giannis as the guy in the NBA, it seems.
Mm-hmm. So, well, we'll see what the coaching carousel does for those other two guys. So right. Nick Nurse might be the right doctor for Joel.
Yeah, the whole Doc Nurse thing. I don't know how that didn't occur to me until someone else made the joke first.
So, yeah, all right, basketball, blah, blah, blah. Succession finale this past Sunday night, guys. Let's get to the real stuff here. I'm going to open the floor. I mean, I think in the end here, now that it's, you know, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched it, fuck off. In the end, I think it ended exactly – there was no surprises as far as I was concerned, really. You know what I'm saying? Like, we spent so much time, who's going to be the CEO, blah, blah, blah. In the end, it doesn't matter who the CEO is, really. I mean, because that's that. But, like, and Eric had a great idea, like, what's the last shot going to be? When we did that fake odds column, and, I thought it was, I had Kendall as a favorite, obviously the favorite. It's a tragedy. This show's a tragedy. It's Kendall's story, and he's a broken man.
Does he have to be a broken man? And here's why I bring this up. I mean, at the beginning of the season, and this, they just dropped this thread at some point. The Sibs, once they got over their idea to launch the 100, my application's been in for several weeks now, and they haven't gotten back to me about a spot on the staff of the 100. But they had the deal in place to buy Pierce, and that was contingent on the sale of Waystar Royko. So technically, that deal gets triggered, right? If these three siblings can somehow come together, or Kendall can find Stewie and all the guys he's kissing on Molly to invest in their stead. You know, I don't know.
Does Kendall have it in him, though? Like, I mean, he's lost everything. He's lost everything. He's lost his family, his job, his future,
Well, he hasn't lost everything. He still has the money.
Well, he has the money. No,
But he's lost everything else. Yes.
He's lost everything else. Does he have it in him to climb out of that hole? I don't know.
He's still got the body, man, guys. He's right there in that last frame.
Thank God. It's a good thing.
But Kendall being Kendall, all it takes is a couple bumps of some sort of synthetic drug, and he's back on top of the world. So
same.
I think he's on top of Pierce if this series goes any further.
Well, it's not. So that's okay. Eric, right. Please.
No, well, that's sort of the interesting thing is that the series doesn't go any further. This is where it ends. It's not really an ending. Like, I think in the sense that, like, anyone seeing it will say, okay, yes, the musical chairs ended with Tom as CEO. If the series continued 6 months from now, he's probably out and someone else is in power. And, it was just sort of like, this was the stopping point, not necessarily the real conclusion of where their story was headed, and leaving us to discuss what's next, what would have been next for Kendall. Could the Pierce deal still happen? You're absolutely right, though, Mike, that was a big plot point that they just decided to ignore down the stretch.
But the Waystar Royko story is over. And that's the story we've been told. Yes, Tom's CEO. Yes, he's married to Shiv. Yes, he's married to Shiv, but like, it's not their company. It's not the Roy's company anymore. They own nothing of it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So from that perspective, the story is over. You know, I guess what happens to these people, like, going down the road, who the hell knows? But I think I was very happy. I was very satisfied with how everything played out. You guys?
No, I wanted Greg as CEO, as you guys know. And I think if you're looking down 6 months, if you're looking 6 months down the road when Tom gets fired, I think Big Sexy Greg Hirsch is that CEO. He can out Tom in terms of just being a kind of an empty suit for Mattson to funnel his ideas through. Hey, I had a question for you guys. I thought, obviously Alexander Skarsgård was in Zoolander, and so was Owen Wilson. I really feel like the character of Mattson was channeling Owen Wilson's character in Zoolander throughout this final season. Just like psilocybin in the morning, like that stuff really reminded me of Owen Wilson's character in
Zoolander. That's an interesting thought. I will say that I think Mattson was kind of the weak link of the final season in that I never really felt like I understood that character. And I don't know if that's me criticizing Skarsgård or me criticizing the writing or what exactly, but I felt like that character wasn't really tethered to much of anything in terms of what his motivations were or feeling like I knew him. I mean, they obviously he played an important role in the plot wise, but your cousin Greg bet, I think I hear what you're trying to say here is it got graded too early. If this extends, maybe your cousin Greg bet cashes in the future.
Yeah, no, points bet already paid out on it. So I'm good.
Okay, good.
I want to say one other thing. Eric knows this about me, Mike. And he definitely found out like via accident because I was probably doing something. But I am like a 6-year-old, I think. In that, like, if I watch or read or listen to some form of entertainment, generally speaking, I start taking on the personality traits of, like, favorite characters in such a thing. So, like, when I, like, watch The Sopranos, like, I'm walking around the house, like, hey, where's the fucking gabagool? But it's not an act. Like, I'm really doing it. But this show, This show, never once did I walk away from it saying, oh, I'm Kendall Roy. Like, all the characters were so shitty, right? No redeeming qualities. Like, nothing about any of them that I wanted to embody, and yet could not be ripped away from it. I think this show has, you know, we could argue Pantheon, we could argue Best Prestige. I think of all the shows, I think this show has the best shot to be studied in 50 years. You follow what I'm saying? I could see very bored high school students having to slog through this at some point.
Jeff, did you ever go? You remember the Logan's birthday party? Ill to the OG.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You didn't go around the house singing that to your kids all week?
No, I was full of cringe. Listen. Whenever I rap to large audiences, you know, I make sure that, like, you know, we have tested it. You know that I have all my beats and rhymes down.
Smart,
right?
Yeah,
Jay-Z, that's smart.
The only way I'd say I've been influenced by that behavior on the show is I now exclusively ride city bikes to funerals. That's the way that I let it impact me.
I think we're gonna need to put like a little note before the interview starts when we tape the rest of the pod, saying if you don't want to listen to three morons talk about Succession, please, you know, fast forward to the X mark.
Who is the Kendall? Who is the Shiv? And who is the Roman among the three of us? We'll save that for the next appearance.
No, let's do it. Let's do it. Well, all right. So one of us has to be Shiv too. That's interesting. All
sure.
Right.
Yeah, we can bend genders here, I think, to make that work. Clearly, well, Mike showed off his rapping skills, so I guess he's got to be the Kendall.
Ooh. All right. I'll take it. I'll take it.
All right, now you pick who's your Shiv, who's your Roman.
You just said you're a 6-year-old, so I guess you're Roman and I'm Shiv. Mm-hmm. I think that's how it has to land.
All right,
I'd make a great mom. That's all I want to say. All right,
happy womgasming, Eric.
On that note, Mike, thanks for joining us on the pod. Great talking to you. And
anytime.
Next time a prestige drama ends and you have a big long shot bet almost come in, we'll have you on again.
Deal. You guys got it. Thank you so much.
Two men. $10,000. Will they run it up or blow it all? It's time to check in on the Gamble On Bankroll.
Let's update our betting bankroll, and the negative momentum has been reversed, thanks largely to your sharp wagering, Jeff, but it could have been a whole lot better, could have been a much more pronounced momentum reversal if certain things had happened 1/10 of a second later than they did. Before we get to Heat Celtics game 6, though, we had our game 5 bets. I tried to semi-hedge against my Heat in 6 bet by taking them to cover in game 5. It backfired. We lost $105. You won $100 back, though, with over 12.5 points for Derek White, which smashed. Speaking of Derek White, if he doesn't get that tip in to win game 6, we turn my $50 bet into $550, but instead we lost the $50 by 1/10 of a second, maybe by the clock starting 1/10 of a second late. Who knows? A brutal blow to our collection of fake money, and I had it in real life too. So that one hurt a bit. Anyway, in other sports, your baseball bets, another win for betting based on weather reports, as you won $100 on the Padres Nats over. Your Arenado homer bet and the parlay that involved that homer bet got voided since Arenado didn't play last Thursday. And lastly, I got us a winner in boxing. Luis Alberto Lopez was a +105 underdog, and he dominated and knocked out Michael Conlon in the 5th round. We won $105 on that one. So for the week, we won $150. We're now down by $2,842. We also have $1,357 on hold in futures bets, and that leaves us with $5,801 available to bet with this week. And you're up first, Jeff.
They're bigger. They're faster. They're more rested. Nuggets and 4, +460 at FanDuel for $100.
Ah, all right. Nuggets and 4, +460. I like it. I heard some another podcast sort of at much, much lower odds, taking the Nuggets in 4 or 5. I think that was like closer to pretty close to even money. But you're just going all the way here, which when we get to my second bet, we'll learn that we can't possibly win every bet this week. But that's OK. I like this one at +460, and I think it's got a great chance. And yeah, if they we'll talk more about my thoughts on game 1. Actually, I'll dig into them here with a simple bet on the NBA Finals. I'll note that we already have Jokic for Finals MVP at minus 170. I'm very proud of that because his best price now is minus 335. But the bet that I like on game one, the Heat are a mediocre offensive team, excellent defensive team. The Nuggets will be rusty. The Heat will be tired. These Nuggets have never been to the Finals before, as Seeley pointed out. They could be a little tight. To me, it all adds up to betting the under for game one. Bit of a rock fight tonight. That's what I see. So let's go 110 to win 100, under 219.5 points.
All right. All right. I'm going to do a little, I'm going to go off basketball here, do a little baseball.
Okay.
I'm going to turn the clock back 10 years here, and we're going to do a run line parlay. With the Mets giving 1.5 runs and the Red Sox giving 1.5 runs, the Mets to the Phillies and the Red Sox to the, I don't even know who the hell they're playing, and I can't remember. It doesn't matter.
Is it the Reds?
The Reds. Both home, Scherzer and Sale on the Hill. Both, you know, that's where the 10 years ago was coming from. But both have finally looking real sharp this year, like the last, both in their last few starts. The Reds are not a good team. Scherzer, the Phillies, you know, the Phillies are good, but I don't know. At first, I just did a money line parlay, but it was like 150, minus 150, plus 150. That's not good enough for me. So we're going to do the run line parlay. Plus 362 for $100.
Okay. We'll root against it because sure. My Phillies desperately need a win, but at least, you know, there's this is the emotional hedge for me and the emotional all-in for you. So I'm going back to NBA Finals Game 1 for my second bet, but I'm not keeping it simple with just the under here. I'm doing a same-game parlay. Risk a little, probably lose a little, but maybe win a lot. We start with the under 219.5. I'll start with that as my first leg. My second leg, Jokic over a slightly elevated line for rebounds, over 13.5 rebounds. Figure if we're headed for the under on the total, that means plenty of missed shots, more opportunities for rebounds, and 14 in a playoff game is normal for him anyway. He's averaging 13.3. He's playing extra minutes, 39 per game, so over 13.5 rebounds. Now, the one non-correlated leg, Caleb Martin, over 14.5 points. He's red hot. He averaged 19.3 against Boston. I'm not sure it continues all finals, but for game one, why not? He's certainly not going to be afraid to shoot, jacking up between 5 and 8 threes each game. So we need over 14.5 points from him. And then the long shot. This one could well cost us the parlay, but I'm taking Seeley's advice that Miami is live on the money line. We can't win both this bet and your Nuggets and four bet, but for the purpose of this parlay, we're taking them to win the game. Put those four legs together. Miami wins under 219.5, over 13.5 rebounds for Jokic, over 14.5 points for Martin. It's plus 2,500 at BetMGM. So let's go $30 to win $750.
Well, I hope we win that. Yes. Better to win that than the Nuggets sweep. So that was, right. That's good. So now I'll root for that.
Okay.
All right. For my last bet this week, I am sticking to basketball. But going over to the WNBA, the Minnesota Lynx take on the Connecticut Sun tonight. Nafisa Collier, over 16.5 points at FanDuel. They have player props for at WNBA over at FanDuel. I'm going to put $200 down at minus 114.
Okay.
Why 200 instead of my standard? Why am I going two units here?
Yes, why?
She's played five games. She's hit the over four times. The only time she didn't, she fouled out. So, I mean, the offense runs through her, and I'm just taking past performance indicative of future performance here.
Okay. Do you want to beef it up ever so slightly just to make the math easier? So since I don't know what
did I say 200, I meant 228.
228, perfect. Yeah. Even better. So 228 to win 200.
Yeah.
Okay. I like that much better.
That's what I meant.
Okay. So for my final bet, or bets as it turns out, I asked my brother Dave for some French Open bets. He follows tennis much more closely than I do. It's a little tricky with matches going on as we record Thursday morning, so some bets are unavailable. For example, he likes the men's 6-seed Rune to make the finals on the weaker side of the bracket, but we can't bet that right now. So we're just going to go as long range as we can and bet on the two favorites to win the title. On the men's side, Carlos Alcaraz is as high as plus 145 at FanDuel, so let's go 100 to win 145 on him, and we'll have fun rooting for him to beat Djokovic in the semis if and when they both get there.
Djokovic plays tennis also?
Sorry, you're right. It's close. You know what? It's Djokovic, right? Djokovic. I mispronounced it because I've got Jokic in my head. But
Djokovic,
if we could combine them into one, or or Jokic, I guess, would be the other way to sort of fuse their names. But this is, yes, Novak Djokovic. Okay, yeah, boy, sorry. Boy, it's all confused. All these letters and sounds mean nothing now in my brain. so that's 100 to win 145 on Alcaraz. And on the women's side, Iga Swiatek is minus money at some sports books, but she's still plus 105 at BetMGM to win the tournament. So let's go 100 to win 105 on her. I'm being very boring and betting the chalk, but you know, sometimes it pays to be boring.
Yeah, hopefully. Sure.
All right. That'll do it for this episode of Gamble On. Thanks, everybody out there, for listening. And thanks again to this week's guest, Mike Seeley. You can find me on Twitter at Eric Raskin and Jeff at Jeff Edelstein, and follow US Bets at US underscore bets. Go to usbets.com for all the latest news and analysis from the world of gambling, and subscribe to this podcast on Megaphone, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else. And with that, Jeff, please take us out.
Eric, remember COVID? You remember COVID, I'm sure. Yeah, you know, yeah. It feels like a million years ago that we were locked down, but it's only been 3 years. It's only been three. Things have dramatically changed since then. One of the things that have changed, as everyone knows, is the concept of work. You know, mm-hmm. I think Stephen Roth, I've read this in the New York Times, great quote. Stephen Roth, CEO of Vornado Realty Trust, this is what he says on an earnings call when discussing the five-day work week. He says, "I think you can assume Friday is dead forever. Monday is touch and go." And it's the truth. So many people that I know in, like, you know, basically what, like, I guess what we could call white collar jobs, Fridays have really become like non-existent for like getting anything done. At best, maybe you're getting things set up for the following week. Maybe it's always been like this, but I feel like now it's like a thing. Like, it's just understood, right?
Right.
So today I call on our national leaders to officially make Friday part of the weekend. Other countries like Iceland and Japan have been dipping their toes in this. A lot of U.S. towns and cities are playing around with it. And
if I may interrupt, if we make Friday part of the weekend, then doesn't sort of Thursday become a slack off day like Friday currently is?
Hopefully. Okay. But I do think that the sports books of America, by the way, what does it have to do with gambling? Well, here we go. Okay. I think the sports books of America should lead the charge on this, because what, after all, right? If you're running a sports book, turning Friday into a weekend day is only going to be good for your bottom line. You know what I'm saying? It's just another day of like daytime sports and nighttime sports. You know, it's a 24/7 sports now all of a sudden. And also, think about this. Think of the goodwill that you know, the DraftKings and the FanDuels of the world will get when there are commercials which run 24/7. Instead of begging people to bet, now they're going to be begging our national leaders to create a four-day work week, right? They're going to be begging our leaders to take Friday up behind the woodshed and just kill it once and for all. This is easily the best idea I've ever had. Someone get me Jason Robbins on the phone. Let's do this. Let's make Friday an one extra day to gamble on.